Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and miniseries. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes back Ned Sublett to kick off a new Latin Roll miniseries based on Ned's classic book, Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today Ned Sublett returns to discuss his book, Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. Ned, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back.
So I'm really excited to talk to you about this book, and we're only going to talk about a little bit at the front because this thing is a mammoth undertaking. One of my listeners, this is the first book that was recommended to me by a listener. I knew jack about Cuban music. Going into this, I thought I knew all about the history of American music and realized, whoa, there's at least a third, if not a half, of the story that I don't understand at all. And this book helped me understand that enormously. So first off, thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted that the book has been of use to people. And I keep hearing, 20 years after its publication almost, I keep hearing from people who have found it. And it seems to be helping. I'm delighted because I really wrote the book to answer my own questions. I really didn't think anyone would ever read it. I was just, there were these things I wanted to understand myself about the course that music took. And the book was the answer to those questions.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. It definitely, I mean, obviously can't answer all the questions, but as you call it, Cuba is the elephant in the living room of American music. What did you mean by that?
I mean, you know, I can remember back. I'm an old guy. I was born in 51. So I remember back before the Cuban Revolution when Cuban music was really omnipresent one way or another in the music of the United States in a kind of a visible way that after the revolution, it fell into a black hole and people forgot all about it. But Cuba was always present and in all kinds of ways. And going back to the earliest days, which is, of course, what I track in the book, is just how far back this goes, the influence of Havana, the first great music capital of the hemisphere, on the developing music of North America.
So there's something you say in the preface of the book that I should have mentioned already. And you say that music, far from being a universal language, is made in the spaces created by societies and empire. And we have to know what those societies and empires were if we want to understand this music. And that's been the involuntary subtext of this whole series. When I decided to start doing this with Ed Ward, I thought it would be a much simpler thing, and I could talk about music to take my mind off of current events. And unfortunately, all I'm doing is immersing myself in current events and the current events of the past that we call history that got us here. So there's a lot of ugly history that comes with this story. We're talking about empire. We're talking about mass enslavement of human beings. We're talking about mass forced migrations of human beings. We're talking about mass voluntary migrations of human beings. We're talking about mass genocide of human beings. So a whole lot of ugly stuff, but I think you can boil it down to as collision. And I think that's a term you use a lot. And that you say that the collision, what was it about Cuba that made it the collision, the biggest music and cultural collision in the history of the world?
Well, first of all, at one time, the Spanish laid claim to the entire hemisphere. They weren't in a position to enforce that claim, and they didn't weren't able to make it for all that long without a competition. But when the Spanish were running the show, Havana was the hub. Havana is located at the end of a narrow, defensible channel. It's a marvelous deep water bay right at the Gulf, right at the place where the loop current out of the Gulf of Mexico passes through the Straits of Florida to create the Gulf Stream, the most powerful current in the world's oceans, one branch of which goes pretty much directly back to Spain. So Havana was the shipping hub of the centuries-long operation that ripped sugar and gold out of the bowels of Mexico and Peru, and did I say sugar and gold? Silver and gold out of the that ripped silver and gold out of the bowels of the New World and sent it back to Europe, where it on occasion tripled the money supply of silver. So it was a vital hub of the operation. Sailors and other travelers from all parts of the Americas wound up in Havana for weeks and months at a time waiting to ship back to Spain. So as the Afro-Latin hemisphere came into being, Havana was the hub. Havana was the place where everything creolized, so to speak, where all the new developments that had happened, whether they be in Panama or Peru, would wind up simmering, shall we say, in the taverns and the shipyards of Havana. This, in turn, created a situation in which, well, let's just say that Havana is 200 years older than New Orleans, right? At the time the 13 colonies became independent, Havana was much bigger than any city in the nascent United States. It was a great city when New York was a village. So Havana was the first great music capital of the hemisphere. And a lot of people crossed paths in Havana, but in particular, people from Spain and people from various parts of Africa.
And I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first musical snippet. And when we come back, you can explain to people this non sequitur, because I'm about to introduce Alcantara by Al-Safi, Fakhri, and Shaheen from the Two Tenors and Kantara album. And when we come back after we hear this, you can explain why am I starting this with some Arabic music. Thank you. That was El Cantara by Al-Safi Fakhri and Shaheen from the Two Tenors and Cantara album. And they're playing an oud is the lead instrument there, if I'm pronouncing that right. Mm-hmm. Ned, solve the mystery. Why am I starting this with Arabic music? Am I just doing the wrong show?
For the same reason that I went back all the way to the 7th century BC in starting Cuba and its music, which on the face of it is pretty strange. If you're writing a book about Cuban music, why would you start it that far back? Because if you're writing a book for certainly for consumption in the United States, people don't really know what Spain was, and they don't know what Africa was, and you've got to explain it. You got to give some sense of that. So, of course, Spain was, as of 711, under the 711 AD, under the was an Islamized country. It was a Muslim. Iberia was Muslim. Much of it for three centuries. Some of it for eight centuries. And this created a new culture in Spain that had not existed in North Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, or in Baghdad. It created an Iberian culture, which was then exported to all parts of the Americas, and where it then, to use that word, collided with the music of the enslaved Africans who were brought from, again, various parts of Africa with various different musical traditions, some of which were themselves Islamized.
Yeah, in the book you describe, you say when Europeans began bringing people from coastal Africa into Europe and later the New World, they initiated perhaps the greatest culture shock in the history of music. The music of Europe, which was by that time a complex product of an evolution that stretched from Mesopotamia, Egypt, India, Phoenicia, the Levant, Anatolia, Persia, Greece, through the Roman Empire, the Islamic Empire, and Europe in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, collided with the music that had been evolving mostly in isolation all that time in Forest Africa. And we'll get to the music of Forest Africa, but I wanted to talk a little more about the music of Spain and Northern Africa, which you've already established why they were so closely connected, because there's this 800-year period where the Spain is part of Islam. Arabs rule over the Iberian Peninsula, or most of it. But a tiny corner in the Northwest, the Galician part where my wife's family came from, was basically of not worth enough to invade. And eventually, the Christians used that foothold to reconquer the peninsula by 1492, a year that some of us may remember from school, and imposed the Spanish language over that. Tell us about the role of the Spanish language in Cuban music.
Well, the role of the Spanish language in the hemispheric culture is something that we have to take into account, because it was a standardized language. In 1492, precisely, Elio Antonio de Nebrija presented Queen Isabel with his Castilian grammar. This was something that did not exist for vernacular European languages, with the exception of Occitan, of southern France, which had previously had its own grammar. But Latin was a structured language with rules and a written literature. It was the language of science and communication. But now the bureaucrats and diplomats and sailors and conquistadores could communicate in a language that they actually spoke, which was standardized throughout the growing Spanish Empire. So they had a language that was transferred with really remarkable uniformity, I think, all across much of the hemisphere. You know, people in Colorado can understand people in Chile today because of that. And that certainly, obviously, is fundamental to understanding what happened in Cuba.
And it also, because Spanish is such an easy language to rhyme, it allowed the creation of these elaborate rhyming structures that we still hear today in the corridos in Mexico when they you know sing the songs to the drug dealers and everything. And this format that comes directly from Spain, right?
Well, yeah. The corrido in Mexico goes back to the medieval era. It's with these, as you said, these rhyming structures that were quite formulaic and conventional. The decima, my favorite example, the decima espinela, invented by Vicente Espinela, with its 10-line structure, is cultivated through in all parts of the Americas, and it was cultivated by people who couldn't necessarily read, but who could improvise orally, who had mastery of oral literature, who had memorized great poetry orally and could follow the rhyme structures and argue with each other in verse in poetic competition as something that goes back quite far in history and certainly was cultivated in the pre-Islamic Arabic era as well.
There's one other thing you say about Spanish language, and this is from the perspective of North Americans, United Statesians. You say that anybody speaking Spanish is going to be the other from our perspective. And when they come to America and contribute to our culture, there's always an otherness when they sing their songs because they're in the other language. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's still true that the music that is in Spanish is by much of United States media considered in some sense impenetrable or ununderstandable. We can make up whatever stories we like about it because we don't understand it. I'm afraid that's still the case. I do think we're at an interesting moment, however, because of as much bad stuff as is happening right now, we're at this revolutionary moment in technology where the language barrier is starting to come down. Vis-a-vis, you know, machine translation, stuff like that. I can, for example, I don't speak Haitian Creole very well, but I can correspond in it with the judicious and careful aid of Google Translate. We are able now, if I find a piece of news in Arabic or Japanese, I can get the gist of it through automatic translation. And once we have that to the point where we can use it readily in conversation, it's going to be a very interesting world that was unimaginable in the decades I grew up in. I'm curious to see what that will bring. Meanwhile, people still make lame jokes about not being able to speak Spanish and mispronounce Spanish names. One thing that really gets my goat is when radio announcers mispronounce Spanish names. It seems to me if you're an announcer, you ought to know how to pronounce. Especially, and if you're in the United States, I think if you want to call yourself an educated person in the United States, you need to understand Spanish because it's not a foreign language. In the parts of the United States where I grew up, Spanish was spoken long before English was.
Very true, very true. And I should apologize to all of our listeners for my abysmal Spanish and basically all foreign language and a lot of English, standard English pronunciation as well. And I want to play our next song.
Actually, you've been doing good. You've been doing good, Nate.
Well, thank you, Ned. Thank you. I've been working on it. And this is our next song snippet. This is Ray Charles, Hit the Road, Jack. When we come back, I'll ask Ned to explain the connection. And that was Hit the Road, Jack, a classic from the 1960s by Ray Charles. And I picked that for two reasons. One is it features a pretty straight version of the Spanish cadence, which is a chord progression that you hear in flamenco. But it also, I wanted to use it because And this was one of the big revelations to me in this book, is there's something very different about North American African-American music, which, if you have a better way to say that, please let me know. But there's something very different, two big differences really, between the music we're used to hearing from African-Americans and Afro-Cuban music. And I'm talking about swing and blue notes. And why is it that the Africans brought to North America developed such a different musical tradition than Cuban music, which is incredibly polyrhythmic, but doesn't swing and doesn't, it does have blue notes, but not emphasized in the same way?
Yeah, I would argue that, and I make, I spend a fair amount of space in Cubanist music making this argument, that a major difference in the music of the United States versus the rest of the hemisphere is the presence of Senegambians, the heavy presence of Senegambians as first populators in the three major fountainheads of African-American culture, the Chesapeake, Charleston / Low Country, and to a smaller but still significant degree, the Gulf Coast. The Africans who were brought to these places, the peak of that slaving happened just at the time when Senegambia was throwing large numbers of captives onto the market, and also the journey from that part of Africa was much shorter than from farther down, which meant more of the kidnapped human cargo arrived alive and was preferred by slave owners. Plus, of course, Senegambians brought such knowledge as the cultivation of rice, which in the case of the Low Country was very important. And the music of Senegambia is a very, very different cultural and musical region than, say, Congo. Far down to the south, Senegambia was Islamized. Senegambia had this melismatic. I would say one of the big differences is the presence of melisma, multiple notes on a single vowel in African American music, which we hear in Arabic music and we hear in the music of the Senegambia, and much less so in music of Congo, for example. Now, this population was, I won't say no Senegambians were brought to Cuba, but large numbers were not, and they do not figure in a really visible way in Afro-Cuban culture. For one thing, the Spanish did not want them because they were Islamized, and they had the Christian kings of Spain had spent centuries driving Muslims out of Iberia. Meanwhile, Congo had been Catholicized as of 1491, that is the year before Columbus. So Congo were Catholics, and the Spanish wanted them. So this made for a very different demographic movement to the United States and Cuba. I wouldn't say that this is the only reason that the musics are different. There's obviously, this is really a complex story with a lot of factors, but I think this is a really important structural part of the story.
Absolutely. And it jibes with things I've learned from studying my own Scots-Irish heritage from people like David Fisher's Albion Seeds, where
great book.
Yeah, it's absolutely essential to understand America, I believe. And you know, in settling the new world and, you know, genociding the previous culture, basically a year zero approach, and new populations come in, that the dominant population in an area like the Dutch in New York or the Saxon Protestants in Boston or the Norman descendants of royalty in Virginia set the tone for a culture that continues. So even though the Senegalese in North America were later overwhelmed by populations coming from other parts of Africa, they still had that first mover advantage. And you can definitely hear that in our music and this relationship to Arabic music. And it, you know, so much of the things I had learned about the history of blues and the history of rock and roll were totally wrong. And you know, many of these things have been episodes after episode on. But one of the big things that was totally wrong to me was the way that blues was so often portrayed as some sort of primordial ancient African music from the heart of the Congo, when it really appears like it was a modern music invented in the late 19th century with heavy influence from Arabia and India, and much more. The Senegalese were much more part of the conversation that the Spanish were part of, that had been interacting with everybody all around, you know.
Well, I mean, the blues was an African-American invention, and you can hear, you know, heavily the influence of Islamized Africa in it. You can, Bob Palmer argued, however, for the presence of Congo vocal dynamics in the blues, which I think is pretty, I mean, certainly Congo was part of it, but by the time the blues were invented, it had been a long time since Africans had come in to the United States. The importation from Africa was shut off in 1808, and we had a domestic slave raising industry, so that the people in Mississippi were not, you know, they were not people from Africa working chopping cotton in the deep South. They were mostly trafficked down from, you know, Virginia or Maryland. So this was something that had a long time to cook and become American. At the same time, there's that great book by Gerhard Kubik, Africa and the Blues, that maps musicological traits of the blues onto regions of Africa where those same traits are found. And you find heavily in the a heavy concentration inland, just below the Sahara. There's a lot of that influence in there. I would also say that the difference between these two musics, we don't have the blues in Cuba, right? There's nothing like this. Also, a lot of other stuff we don't have. For example, we don't have the Bible in Cuba in the same way. We don't have the Bible thumping preacher. We don't have Bible stories in Cuban lyrics because Protestantism was forbidden there. So there are other influences as well.
And let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll introduce Sub-Saharan Africa and what it brought to Cuba that is not so present in North America.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them?
was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And so another thing that I learned from this book that was probably obvious to everybody else, but hit me like a 2x4 between the eyes, was the rhythmic complexity that goes on in Cuban music and the way it's held together by the clave and where that came from. This idea of like your lecture on the influence of Latin music on Louie Louie. Like I kind of knew that. I knew that, you know, Ritchie Valens' big hit was a direct influence on Louie Louie. I knew that Richard Berry had been listening to music from the Caribbean, you know, but I was thinking more Harry Belafonte. But the real, and I didn't understand what the big deal was. I didn't understand the difference between the three chord blues sequence and the three chord Louie Louie sequence, although I could play them both, but in a theoretical level, I didn't understand. What's so special about the sort of Louie Louie, these little rhythmic patterns that are looped endlessly?
Yeah, well, Louie Louie was a direct rewrite of the El Loco Cha-Cha, as it was called in English, by René Touzet, the number one Cuban band leader in L.A. in the 50s. And it was, in Spanish, it was called Amar en el Loco, and it was composed by Rosendo Ruiz Hijo, who was at the time the biggest hit composer of cha-cha-chas, having written, you know, Rico Vacilón and others. So it was he was a hot composer of the day. My basic recipe for early rock and roll, my basic reductionist, quick and dirty, leaves a lot out recipe, is boogie woogie meets cha cha cha. And the if you listen to the El Loco Cha Cha, of course, the basic lick is bum 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 bum. The melody of the tune is irrelevant. Richard Berry then went on and wrote a whole song on top of that. You can also listen to any number of examples because, as I say, in the 50s, Cuban music was omnipresent in the U.S. And the African-American swing feel and the Afro-Cuban straight eights feel were mixing up and hybridizing in all kind of ways, a process that had been going on all along, but which really got a catalyst in 1931 with the hit recording of El Manicero, the peanut vendor, and then a second major jolt in the late 40s with the work of Chano Pozo with Dizzy Gillespie, which introduced the tumbadora or conga drum and a different sense of how to build a song. And Chano's music drove Dizzy's people nuts because it didn't seem to go anywhere. It just looped. And this is, of course, now this is so basic to our pop music that we take it for granted. But African-American music did not do that. African-American music was based on chord progressions. It might be the three chord progression of the blues, but as you said, that's dealt out over 12 bars. You know, you have 4 bars of G, 2 bars of C, 2 bars of G, D, C, etc. But in, you know, in any number of pop records in the, certainly by the 60s, you get these 1-4-5-4 over and over and over. You can name literally hundreds of records that do that, and that all comes in from Cuba.
And it gives the music this incredible power to be played over and over again. I can remember a famous club in Austin that was shut down, and I believe Liberty Lounge was shut down around the turn of the millennium, and they had a 24-hour marathon of Gloria by Van Morrison and Them, which is one of these mm-hmm. songs that has this little three chord endless loop sequence. Mm-hmm. And you could do it. You could listen to idiots playing bad versions of Gloria. And they were great musicians and my friends, and I'm not, you know, but it was essentially drunk idiots playing this, you know, very simple pattern for 24 hours. And it, and I could be wrong, it might've been 12 or whatever, but it's, it was a long, long marathon of Gloria. But you could do it. You could play that same tune over and over. Oh, yeah.
Well, when I was in a garage band, you know, back in the mid-60s, and of course we played Louie Louie, it was great because you, as long as people wanted to dance, you could just keep playing it. If you played a another kind, you know, a regular pop song, you would sing the two verses, the bridge, and the third verse, and then you would have to start repeating verses, and you would just go over and over. But in the Cuban song form, there's what I call the pivot. You sing the song proper up front, and then you hit the montuno. Then you hit the part where you just hit a loop, and there's a rhythmic chorus that repeats and gets hotter and hotter while the lead singer improvises over it. It builds, and then you, at some point, you bring it down or you move it to a horn section, which plays what's called a mambo. You come back, you do this some more, and you can keep going back and forth like that, building it as long as the dancers want to keep going. And the dancers understand this format, so they also contribute energy to the music. If this, we're talking about a music that's an open circuit between a live band and live dancers, not dancers locked into a mechanical click. So this kind of form allows for a kind of an unfolding and even improvisation in real time that otherwise you can't get to. And these three chord rock songs kind of harness a little of that energy. You'll notice that many songs at the end hit this power vamp. They ride out on this one vamp that goes over and over. And indeed, that's what happens in Hit the Road, Jack, you were playing earlier. They just take these four chords and just repeat them over and over. And you can, you know, with that, you can build all kinds of structures that it's harder to do with a song form.
Yeah, and that's why almost every pop song on the radio today is a four chord loop of one kind or another that works great in the 30 second TikTok snippet, or stretch it out as far as, say, 2 minutes and 15 seconds for the full, you know, Billie Eilish video or whatever on YouTube. If you
want to. Yeah, songs have lost bridges entirely. They don't bother with them anymore.
Yeah, Ted Joy is always talking about trance and the power of trance in music, and says that, you know, you need at least 10 minutes of the same song going to achieve that trance state. And to me, that explained kind of why I related more to the Velvet Underground when they stretched out Sister Ray for 17 minutes with Mo Tucker seemingly mm-hmm. moronically playing the same beat. It meant so much more to me than, say, Keith Moon or Tony Williams or some kind of rock, or, you know, Ginger Baker or whatever, who's varying what they're doing and trying to tell a story. If they just locked onto that mindless beat, then you could go places with it trance wise and in the book, you introduce us to a lot about African culture and African history, which I knew a little bit about, but you take it back. There is a primordial African music, and I'm talking about the San and the Pygmies. Mm-hmm. What's unique about the music of these people, and why do we think it's some of the oldest music in sub-Saharan Africa?
Ooh, now that's a deep question. You're admittedly in speculative territory here, because it's hard to prove things that go back like this. And the American language, Modern Language Association, I think, has twice prohibited papers speculating on the origin of human language. But the languages of the people called the Baka, or the people called Pygmies, or of the Oisan, go back to a time when people would, well, for example, in the case of the San people, they break up into groups, and they have, when they hunt, and they communicate by clicks. Clicks are part of the language. And this is a percussive moment in language. I argue, without admittedly more than circumstantial evidence, because you can't solve these issues with archaeology, that clicks go back to a time when people communicated percussively. And even not people. Chimpanzees, when they hunt, our closest relative in the animal kingdom, break up into groups and communicate by drumming on buttress logs. So my point here is that the talking drum, drums talk, right? We know this about African drumming. But the question is, was it perhaps not that we learned to talk in some measure from our drums rather than did our drums learn to talk by copying our language?
And let's hear a little bit of pygmy music. And this example kind of gets to the heart of why pygmy we can't music, untangle this stuff.
I should jump in and say pygmy. I was talking about the San people here. Pygmy music is something else, but this is a communal music. This is a music that is sung in groups. The pygmies have this fantastic method of singing where they each person sings a note and they do what is called hocketing, making composite melodies. The idea of this kind of music is that since everyone is participating, everyone can play a part, and everything is part of the whole. There's not a separation between performers and listeners as we are used to thinking of it.
Or even between leaders and followers, as we hear in other African musics. But let's go ahead our sample first. And this is Clementine, the American song, or maybe it's English, I don't know, but it's a song, a tune I remembered, but this is a version recorded by the anthropologist Colm M. Turnbull with the Pygmies of the Ituri Rainforest in the late 1950s. And that was Clementine, I'm even mispronouncing English here, from the Pygmies of the Ituri Rainforest recordings captured by the anthropologist Colm M. Turnbull in the late 1950s. And it's amazing how they can take a familiar melody and make it sound so different and alien and refreshing. And the bit about no call and response in pygmy music really blew me away, because call and response is one of the things, you know, in our series we've been doing on here, the Holy Roll series with Garrett Cash, we've been learning about call and response and how fundamental it is to the African American culture here in North America. But it's not part of pygmy culture, but it's very much part of Cuban culture. Tell us about the Bantu people and the Yoruba people and the people who introduced these notions of hierarchy. You call them cultures of iron in the book.
Yeah, the iron seems to have come to Africa from the north and worked its way down. But fact is that Africans had the power technology of iron. And just as in Norway, there's a blacksmith god, in Congo, there's a blacksmith god. His name is Sarabanda, as in Saraband. In Yoruba land, in present day Nigeria, he's Ogun. The Bantu migration, one of the great migrations of human history, that seems to have happened slowly and gradually over about 5,000 years. Again, not really confirmable by archaeology, but first postulated by linguistic forensics and then confirmed by DNA testing. The people moved from the conjectured Bantu homeland of northeastern Cameroon down a little bit, moving a little farther every generation as lands became exhausted, denuded of vegetation, which was needed to stoke the fires to smelt iron. It slowly, this Bantu language group moved down across a massive area of Central and Southern Africa. And when we think of Bantu today, perhaps the first thing we think of is Congo. The Bantu languages went all the way down into, you know, present day Zimbabwe, et cetera. In Nigeria, now, as I mentioned earlier, Congo was Catholicized in 1491 when Italian Capuchin missionaries arrived following the Portuguese contact with Congo in 1483. But meanwhile, up in what's sometimes called Lower Guinea, that is present day Nigeria, Benin, Cameroon, there was neither Catholicization or Islamization, and the traditional religions were practiced syncretism. Yoruba religion probably was syncretized with Islam to some degree, but they were basically worshiping ancestral deities. And I'm a long way from call and response here, but there's this massive call and response notion that goes really all across Africa. The fact that pygmies don't have it relates to their even older status. The pygmies were largely colonized or dominated by the Bantu. And the two musics, to some degree, melded. That is to say, the Bantu took on aspects of pygmy music, as conquerors have done from the conquered forever. And
yeah, you've got a line in the book I have to quote. I have to quote this one line in the book because you put it so perfectly. You said, "Presumably the Bantu learned music from their pygmy vassals in the same way masters have learned music from slaves everywhere." And any North America with any inkling of our heritage, that should really hit you. Like, the same process that we've engaged in happened in Africa between the Bantu and the pygmy way back.
I make a lot about the differences between African American and Afro-Cuban music, because I think it's important to understand them. But you can also look at it from the opposite perspective. What do they have in common? And they have a lot in common. As Chano and Dizzy pointed out, you know, Dizzy doesn't speak Spanish, I don't speak English, but we speak African. One of the things is call and response. So basic. So fundamental and so much a part of African music all throughout the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the pygmies seem to have contributed this idea of the repeating rhythmic cell that, you know, plays a simple pattern over and over again. But the Bantu then bring this call and response and hierarchical aspect to it that then becomes so important in Cuba as well. And let's go ahead.
And the music that were brought to the Americas were in no sense primitive. I just want to say this right now. I don't think your listeners probably think they were, but there has always been this notion out there that the music from Africa was something very primordial. It was a very, very complex music, highly in Cuba, especially, where we can see it to this day, the religious beliefs, the culture of the music of the people was contained in the music. The music kept the religion alive. The religion kept the music alive. And anyone who's been to a ceremony in Cuba today, and where the African religions are practiced all across the island, knows what I'm talking about. Of course, it's not just in Cuba. You find this practice going on all over the hemisphere. But in Cuba, it's been preserved, adapted, and transformed to an astonishing degree.
Absolutely. And let me play our next song snippet. And this is kind of an unusual one I found on YouTube that isn't particularly well documented So I don't know exactly what it is, but it's the first sound is a tribal African recording featuring call and response. And then it segues into Little Richard doing some call and response with his audience. So this is a classic example of what Adizi and Chava were talking about with speaking African. Call and response.
Well, all right, everybody. Yeah. I just got back from my tour in England. Yeah. Everybody's talking about the rock and quave over in England. Yeah. It's a quave. Yeah. Everybody love it. Yeah. I just finished my tour in Germany. Yeah. I just left Italy. Yeah. I went on down in Sweden. Yeah. I stopped over in Belgium. Yeah. And I went on down in France. Yeah. I went over in Australia. Yeah. Everybody's shaking.
Yeah. And that was Little Richard doing a live version of A Whole Lot of Shaking going on, preceded by some African tribes people doing call and response in their tribal music. And now I want to ask you, what was different about Spain and Cuba's model of slavery? We've talked about this a little bit with the New Orleans episode. How was it that these infusions, I mean, Spain started their empire so much earlier. Why was it that Cuba was kind of late to mass importation of enslaved peoples? And why did it keep going on so long? And what impact did that have on the music?
Well, that's a lot of questions right there. But Spain, the Catholic world had a different way of dealing with African religions than the Protestant world did. The Protestant world simply attempted to stamp it out and prohibit it, confiscate the drums, prohibit the practice of the religions, so that in Virginia, people practiced. They practiced the old hoodoo religion, really, and I actually think that it was the First Amendment that stimulated the great growth of the Black Church in America, because with the guarantee of religious freedom, Black people could form their own churches in a way that they had not really been able to do on the cotton plantations during slavery days. This, though, was Protestantism, because the African religions had been taken away and prohibited. In Cuba, that's too simple an account, but it's fundamentally true. In Cuba and in the rest of the Catholic hemisphere, the practice was different. Specifically in Cuba, they had what were called cabildos de nación, which were national organizations where people could affiliate with people from a certain part of Congo or a certain part of Dahomey or wherever. There were, a certain part of Calabar. And behind the closed doors, the cabildos, the religions continued to be practiced. They actually only started to be criminalized really after independence as a U.S. neo-colony. In the early 20th century, the drums began to be confiscated. But the point is that the religions and their drum lore that were brought from Africa could continue to live, be studied, remembered, and transmitted behind the closed doors of the cabildos by recent arrivals, in some cases from Africa. Bear in mind that you asked about why Cuba was so late in its peak of slaving. There were slaves in Cuba from the beginning. There were African slaves in Cuba from the beginning, as well as free Black people. But it wasn't really until after the British took Havana briefly in 1762 and stepped up Cuba's sugar industry, and Bourbon Spain started to give the planters of Cuba more freedom to import Africans, that there started to be a larger traffic as Cuba's sleepy sugar industry started to ramp up, And with the Haitian Revolution taking out one of the world's two major sugar suppliers, along with Jamaica, there was a massive hole in the market for Cuba to fill. And the first three decades of the 19th century were bonanza years for Cuban sugar planters, and they imported vast numbers of captive Africans. And after 1850, when the British Navy stopped the slave trade to Brazil from Africa, Cuba was the last place in the world still importing captive Africans, which they did often through American flagged vessels, which the British would not stop. And the last known slave ships were in the 1860s. It really finally stopped with the U.S. Civil War. But what this means is that when Mongo Santa Maria was born in 1920 in Havana, the elders in his barrio were from Africa. This was a much more recent cultural infusion. Africans brought culture into Cuba from the early 16th century into the 1860s, and so that with the result that you can find people in Cuba today. Well, I knew a man who died in his late 80s, early 90s, a few years ago, whose father had been brought from Africa as a child in the 1860s. So the connections are still that close.
And I want to get to one last thing, and I should have gotten this sooner, because there were indigenous people in Cuba when the Spanish arrived, the Tainos, if I'm pronouncing it right.
The Tainos, yeah.
They're essentially just, you know, murdered and genocided and diseased to the point they don't exist. But you do speculate early on about a musical right they had called an arieto.
The arieto.
Arieto. And do you think that the Tainos, is there any echo of their traditions in the Afro-Cuban music we hear today?
There is, the lore says that there is, and I should point out that the Taino were eliminated as a separate cultural force, but it's not entirely correct to say that they were completely exterminated, because there are plenty of Taino descended people in Cuba today. What happened, of course, was that Spanish, who by and large were men, did not bring so many Spanish women, and took indigenous women as concubines and wives. And so the resultant children were considered to be Spanish or Creole, but were actually, in terms of DNA, they were carrying Taino. You can see Taino facial features commonly in Cubans today, and there are communities, especially in the East, that are very heavily Taino, certainly in phenotype. There's a saying in Eastern Cuba, and I'm not going to comment on its accuracy, except to say that maybe that the son brings together Spanish, African, and indigenous in the form of the African drum, the Spanish stringed instrument, and the maraca. Now, I would say that there are, of course, maracas in Africa as well. And of course, the Tainos had drums as well. But there's something back there, but we can't really pick it out as a strong separate cultural element in the way that we can detect the massive presence of Africa in explicit detail and great variety.
Yeah, because we can go to West Africa and hear the music that's there, and hear the amazing connections, and it's obviously impossible to do that since we obliterated the Taino culture. But I'm so glad to hear that the mestizo, you know, genes survive through the process of blending, and this blending is, you know, the human evolutionary process. And this has resulted in this incredible music, the Afro-Cuban music, which is incredible in its own right. But we're going to talk, and you're going to come back in a couple of weeks, and we're going to talk more about the details of the different African tribes and what they brought. And this whole African science, I mean, to me, I see this African science of rhythm that was developed in sub-Saharan Africa. It's easily as complicated as what Bach was doing with the well-tempered clavier in Enlightenment Europe. And these two, you know, cultures collided with the dominant culture having no respect or regard or understanding for the complexity of the others. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, music copyright only covers melody, chords, and lyrics, and rhythm is just left out completely. But we'll get to that next time. My guest has been Ned Sublett. The book is Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. Hopefully we covered the first drums, and next time we'll get closer and closer to the mambo. Thanks so much for coming back, Ned.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes back Tony Fletcher to discuss his book, All Hopped Up and Ready to Go, Music from the Streets of New York, 1927 to 1977. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.